We are together again, this time finishing the last chapter in the Yoga of Divine Love, the mystery of love. Sri Aurobindo has been saying how all experiences, all paths, lead to the discovery of the divine. So we take it up from there. All the relations by which this union comes about become on this path intensely and blissfully personal. That which in the end contains, takes up, or unifies them all is the relation of lover and beloved, because that is the most intense and blissful of all, and carries up all the rest into its heights, and yet exceeds them. And now Sri Aurobindo will describe a number of possible relations, all reaching fruit in the unification of lover and beloved. He is the teacher and guide, and leads us to knowledge. At every step of the developing inner light and vision, we feel his touch like that of the artist molding our clay of mind, his voice revealing the truth and its word, the thought he gives us to which we respond, the flashing of his spears of lightning which chase the darkness of our ignorance. Especially in proportion as the partial lights of the mind become transformed into lights of gnosis, in whatever slighter or greater degree that may happen, we feel it as a transformation of our mentality into his, and more he becomes the thinker and seer in us. We cease to think and see for ourselves, but think only what he wills to think for us, and see only what he sees for us. And then the teacher is fulfilled in the lover. He lays hands on all our mental being to embrace and possess, to enjoy and use it. So this, the way of knowledge. Note too that this is consonant in the Veda and in the Tantra. This sort of relationship between the human and the divine. He is the master. Remember, the Isha Upanishad is about the Lord, the master of the universe, who indwells in the cosmos, but exceeds the cosmos. He is the master. But in this way of approach, all distance and separation, all awe and fear and mere obedience disappear, because we become too close and united with him for these things to endure, and it is the lover of our being who takes it up and occupies and uses and does with it whatever he wills. So this is in contradistinction with the theistic religions who want or who suggest to us this enormous gulf between God, the divine above, and we puny mortals here. And the best we can do is approach with trepidation, with much worship, preparing for the onslaught of that greatness. And if we come close to it, if it enters into proximity with us, it's too shattering an experience for us to bear. Well, that's the numinous experience, which we've discussed before with a reference back to Rudolf Otto, the theologian of the 20th century. But the Upanishads, the Veda before them, the Gita following, and Sri Aurobindo all insist on the intimate unity of the aspiring human soul with this divine reality. Everywhere we go, that divine is waiting for us involved, fully invested in all that is around us. There's nothing which is not instinct with divinity. So the sense of awe begins to melt away when we recognize that this being is omnipresent, that we too carry that within us. So to be fearful of the divine only means that we feel separated from the divine. Because when we're one, when we're attached to, when we're bonded with, then we feel that closeness. Obedience is the sign of the servant. But that is the lowest stage of this relation, dasya. Afterwards, we do not obey, but move to his will as the string replies to the finger of the musician. To be the instrument is this higher stage of self-surrender and submission. But this is the living and loving instrument, and it ends in the whole nature of our being becoming the slave of God, rejoicing in his possession and its own blissful subjection to the divine grasp and mastery. With a passionate delight, it does all he wills it to do without questioning and bears all he would have it bear, because what it bears is the burden of the beloved being. This probably reminds you, this section, as the previous paragraph was about knowledge, this section is about works. And here, we go back to the book Sri Aurobindo would write a few years later, The Mother, chapters 3 and 5, where he describes this steady ascent of the one who offers the work, from starting with the sense of being the worker, moving into becoming the instrument of the divine, then becoming a channel, and finally, a child, always on the lap of the divine, always at one with that greater being. He is the friend, the advisor, helper, savior in trouble and distress, the defender from enemies, the hero who fights our battles for us or under whose shield we fight, the charioteer, the pilot of our ways. Obviously, this is a reference to Krishna as Purushottama, figured in the human, in the Bhagavad Gita. He is all these things to Arjuna, the aspirant, the great person of the age from the human ranks who learns to work in concert with the divine will. And for one who does this work, the Narada Bhakti Sutras would say, he crosses this Maya, this confusing world, and carries the world also across it. So when we become awake, we awaken that which is about us. When we live from the soul and not from the ego, we begin to unify disparate elements. But sometimes we have to oppose darkness. And so a counselor is needed. Krishna is that. A friend consoles. Krishna is that. One teaches. Krishna reveals. And here we come at once to a closer intimacy. He is the comrade and eternal companion, the playmate of the game of living. We see this also in Indra and Kutsa in the Rig Veda. But still, there is so far a certain division, however pleasant, and friendship is too much limited by the appearance of beneficence. The lover can wound, abandon, be wroth with us, seem to betray. Yet our love endures and even grows by these oppositions. They increase the joy of reunion and the joy of possession. Through them, the lover remains the friend, and all that he does, we find in the end, has been done by the lover and helper of our being for our soul's perfection, as well as for his joy in us. Again, Narada Bhakti Sutras, verse 82. These contradictions lead to a greater intimacy. And let's remember the Gita, chapter 15, shloka 19, in English. He who, undeluded, has knowledge of me as the Purushottama, the Supreme Person, adores me with all knowledge and in every way of his natural being. Adores me, or Bhajati, who is devoted to all knowledge, Sarva Vid, and the natural being, Sarva Bhavena. He is the father and mother too of our being, its source and protector, and its indulgent cherisher and giver of our desires. He is the child born to our desire, whom we cherish and rear. All these things the lover takes up. His love in its intimacy and oneness keeps in it the paternal and maternal care, and lends itself to our demands upon it. All is unified in that deepest, many-sided relation. Krishna is not only father and teacher and guide and charioteer and warrior, but is also worshipped as the divine child, playing as a boy. Again, all is unified in that deepest, many-sided relation. So all possible human relationships are analogs to ways that we can connect with the Supreme. From the beginning, even, it is possible to have this closest relation of the lover and beloved, but it will not be as exclusive for the integral yogin as for certain purely ecstatic ways of bhakti. It will, from the beginning, take into itself something of the hues of the other relations, since he follows too knowledge and works and has need of the divine as teacher, friend, and master. The growing of the love of God must carry with it in him an expansion of the knowledge of God and of the action of the divine will in his nature and living. The divine lover reveals himself. He takes possession of the life. But still the essential relation will be that of love from which all things flow. Love, passionate, complete, seeking 100 ways of fulfillment, every means of mutual possession, a million facets of the joy of union. All the distinctions of the mind, all its barriers and cannot be's, all the cold analyses of the reason are mocked at by this love, or they are only used as the tests and fields and gates of union. Love comes to us in many ways. It may come as an awakening to the beauty of the lover by the sight of an ideal face and image of him, by his mysterious hints to us of himself behind the thousand faces of things in the world, by a slow or sudden need of the heart, by a vague thirst in the soul, by the sense of someone near us, drawing us or pursuing us with love, or of someone blissful and beautiful whom we must discover. Bhagavad Gita, all the Puranas, Sri Lalita Sahasranama, Vishnu Sahasranama, all these enumerate, or at least touch on, the potential of the infinity of the divine being and person. We may seek after him passionately and pursue the unseen beloved, but also the lover whom we think not of may pursue us, may come upon us in the midst of the world and seize on us for his own, whether at first we will or no. He likely has in mind here, again, Sir Francis Thompson, whose great poem, The Hound of Heaven, was one of Sri Aurobindo's favorite. Even he may come to us at first as an enemy, with the wrath of love, and our earliest relations with him may be those of battle and struggle. Where first there is love and attraction, the relations between the divine and the soul may still for long be checkered with misunderstanding and offense, jealousy and wrath, strife and the quarrels of love, hope and despair, and the pain of absence and separation. All these are artfully included in what we typically call bhakti yoga, the yoga of devotion. Sri Aurobindo never had much use for all these shows of despair. We throw up all the passions of the heart against him till they are purified into a soul ecstasy of bliss and oneness. And that was Sri Aurobindo's aim. But that too is no monotony. It is not possible for the tongue of human speech to tell all the utter unity and all the eternal variety of the ananda of divine love. And really here, through the rest of this paragraph, you have to go back and read the Taittiriya Upanishad chapters 8, 9, and 10. Our higher and our lower members are both flooded with it, the mind and life no less than the soul. Even the physical body takes its share of the joy, feels the touch, is filled in all its limbs, veins, nerves with the flowing of the wine of the ecstasy, amrita. Love and ananda are the last word of being, the secret of secrets, the mystery of mysteries. And so too it closes the Bhagavad Gita. Thus, universalized, personalized, raised to its intensities, made all occupying, all embracing, all fulfilling, the way of love and delight gives the supreme liberation. Its highest crest is a supracosmic union. So, the transcendent, the universal, the personal, all at once, a chord of being, all notes sounded together harmoniously. But for love, complete union is mukti. Liberation has to it no other sense, and it includes all kinds of mukti together. Nor are they in the end, as some would have it, merely successive to each other and therefore mutually exclusive. And here he's going to describe the four states of beatitude or mukti, which are enumerated all over the place in the Bhagavata Purana and the Mahabharata, rendered probably in their first allusions all the way back to the Rig Veda. So, we have the absolute union of the divine with the human spirit, sayujya, which means intimate union, united with. In that reveals itself a content of all that depends here upon difference. But there, the difference is only a form of oneness, ananda too, of nearness and contact and mutual presence, samipya, salokya, ananda of mutual reflection, the thing that we call likeness, sadrishya, and other wonderful things too, for which language has as yet no name. So, the four states are sayujya, samipya, salokya, and the fourth he doesn't enumerate here, pardon me, sarupya, which means having the same form. Sadrishya substitutes for it looking the same. I think it's worth noting Narada Bhakti Sutras in its 19th verse says something that's quite consonant with Sri Aurobindo here. The essential characteristics of bhakti are the consecration of all activities by complete surrender to him. In other words, the dynamization of the being and extreme anguish if he were to be forgotten. In other words, we can't live without that connection to the Supreme. If we don't feel that, if we're not consonant, if we're not perennially dwelling in the pure being of the Purushottama, we feel a fire, we feel adrift, we feel anguish. So those wonderful things for which language has as yet no name leads us to the final sentence of the chapter. There is nothing which is beyond the reach of the God lover or denied to him. For he is the favorite of the divine lover and the self of the beloved. And so we go towards the close of the Bhagavad Gita in the 18th chapter and see shlokas 64 and 65. And we stand astonished. Also, look at Bhagavad Gita, the 12th chapter and the early shlokas there, 1 through 9. So, we're called to share the actual status of being that the divine summons from within us, calls us to exceed ourselves and to recover in communion with that person, the fullness of what is possible. Just so, what Krishna is moving upon the earth, the Purushottama, representing the consummation of all being, universalized, conducting all the processes of the universe from a height, but also embodied in a particular personality, is consanguineous with what is possible for us. Because it is there, it can be here. Because the divine does it already, we may do that. And if you prefer the image of the Divine Mother, all the abundant personalities that are possessed in her single being can manifest within us, Should we pursue her in endless form? Recognize that each potentiality in us can become an actuality, a means of establishing union, which then, as was mentioned earlier, we can share with the whole world. Again, Narada Bhakti Sutras. Who crosses this Maya, who leaves behind confusion and delusion, and sees to the depths, recognizing the divine everywhere, carries also the world across. We uplift and transform this where we live. I think this is why we came. So that's the end of the last chapter. It's not the end of the mystery of love by any means. The more we know, the more we learn. It is infinite, so there is ever more to explore. And I'll read a section from Savitri, which is, I think, appropriate. But before I do, next Sunday, let's read...
Sorry, calendar on Apple Watch only goes out 7 days.
Well, that's fascinating. The chapter that we'll take up next time will be the first chapter of the Yoga of Self-Perfection. I don't think we shall do the entire set of essays that Sri Aurobindo left for us there, but I think it might be instructive and remindful to go through the first 1, 2, 3 chapters. So we'll feel our way along, and at the end we will set down the Yoga of Self-Perfection once we draw to us its theme. And the proposal that we have is that we turn next to Essays on the Gita. So I'm telling you now. So if you want to be in touch, if you want to write me an angry letter and chide me for such a rash choice, you may do it. If you say, Rand, we've heard enough of you, and you're reading to us in your drone voice all these chapters and words of Sri Aurobindo and flaying us with your pointless comments, then you may say that. I will listen. I may agree with you. So let me have it. Whatever you think, feel free to let me know. I'm interested in your opinion. This is a section that we've certainly read this before, but I think it's wonderful. I think you will agree this is in Book 7, the Book of Yoga, in Canto 7, the Cosmic Spirit and Cosmic Consciousness. Pardon me. And we'll begin on page 554. A voice began to speak from her own heart that was not hers, yet mastered thought and sense. As it spoke, all changed within her and without. All was, all lived, she felt all being one. The world of unreality ceased to be. There was no more a universe built by mind, convicted as a structure or a sign. A spirit, a being, saw created things and cast itself into unnumbered forms and was what it saw and made. All now became an evidence of one stupendous truth, a truth in which negation had no place, a being and a living consciousness, a stark and absolute reality. There the unreal could not find a place. The sense of unreality was slain. There all was conscious, made of the infinite. All had a substance of eternity. Yet this was the same indecipherable. It seemed to cast from it universe like a dream, vanishing forever into an original void. But this was no more some vague ubiquitous point or a cipher of vastness, an unreal naught. It was the same, but now no more seemed far to the living clasp of her recovered soul. It was herself. It was the self of all. It was the reality of existing things. It was the consciousness of all that lived and felt and saw. It was timelessness and time. It was the bliss of formlessness and form. It was all love and the one beloved's arms. It was sight and thought in one all-seeing mind. It was joy of being on the peaks of God. She passed beyond time into eternity, slipped out of space and became the infinite. Her being rose into unreachable heights and found no end of its journey in the self. It plunged into the unfathomable deeps and found no end to the silent mystery that held all world within one lonely breast, yet harbored all creation's multitudes. She was all vastness and one measureless point. She was a height beyond heights, a depth beyond depths. She lived in the everlasting and was all that harbors death and bears the wheeling hours. All contraries were true in one huge spirit, surpassing measure, change, and circumstance. An individual, one with cosmic self, in the heart of the transcendence miracle and the secret of world personality, was the creator and the lord of all. Mind was a single innumerable look upon himself and all that he became. Life was his drama, and the vast a stage. The universe was his body, God its soul. All was one single immense reality, all its innumerable phenomenon. Namaste, Jai Ma.